Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo's Gaelic football team on the west coast of Ireland.
When you look at the amount of times they've reached a final, you almost start believing something's not right.
Believing in the curse.
Amazing sports stories. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 13th of December, these are our main stories. A case of good cop, bad cop, as delegates at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai finally reach agreement on fossil fuels, but some call it a death certificate. Experts warn that Sudan is heading towards what's been called a hunger catastrophe after months of conflict. Protesters have broken into the Indian Parliament, leaping from the visitors' gallery and setting off a smoke canister. Also in this podcast...
In the TV show, it's like he's this psychotic killer, but there's this deeper side to him.
How Netflix's universe of Stranger Things is opening up a whole new chapter in a whole new format. A new deal has been agreed at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai after days of negotiations. For the first time, the agreement calls on all countries to move away from using fossil fuels. The United States climate envoy John Kerry said it showed commitment to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
This document sends very strong messages to the world. First, the document highlights that we have to adhere to keeping 1.5 degrees within reach. That is the North Star. And we, therefore, must do those things necessary to keep the 1.5, everything we can to achieve this goal.
But not everyone is convinced. The head of the Marshall Island delegation, John Silk, compared the deal to a leaky sea vessel.
Mr. President, Excellencies, I came from my home island to work with you all to solve the greatest challenge of our generation. I came here to build a canoe together for my country. Instead, we have built a canoe with a weak and leaky hull, full of holes. Yet we have to put it into the water because we have no other option.
I spoke to our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, and asked him if the deal really is a breakthrough.
A breakthrough is a very strong word. I think it is an interesting progression on the road. It's probably the most significant climate deal that's been done since the Paris Agreement was signed 8 years ago in 2015. So people have been using words like historic and breakthrough, as you said. I'm not quite sure it meets those particular high points. It is certainly progress, and compared to where the parties were 2 days ago when there was no mention of the end of fossil fuels at all, I think many people will consider it a bit of a win.
It is calling for countries to transition away from using fossil fuels. I mean, what does that mean?
Yes, indeed. It's a very not a very strong phrase to use in that sense. I think that particular key part of it is much more strong than what had been there previously, which was nothing, essentially. Countries could do a number of different things. Now they're being called on to transition away from fossil fuels in the energy sector. But it puts it in the framework of taking a lot of rapid action in the next number of years, tripling renewable energy by 2030, doubling energy efficiency. Everybody has to put new plans on the table by 2025, strong plans that keep the 1.5 goal in sight. And everybody has to get to net zero by 2050. So it's soft in the language. It's not the hardest move away from fossil fuels that there could have been, or many people here would have wanted it to be. But I think it's signalling a major change on the road to that phase out, on the road to that phase down over the next number of decades.
You've covered many of these summits. What else has struck you about this final agreement and indeed this whole summit?
I think it's interesting here that, you know, people and delegates are very practical minded, and I think they're seeing this as a step, and they're not willing to die in the road for this particular agreement. I think they see it as a step on the road to ending fossil fuels, and I think that's clear in the text that it does signal that. There are many caveats, many get-out-of-jail cards, undoubtedly there are, but I think people here are seeing this as part of a trilogy, if you like. Next year the COP goes to Azerbaijan, they will discuss finance there, and the year after it goes to Brazil, where I think all these elements may come together under the Brazilian presidency in 2025. I think that's potentially the next big, big moment when countries will really have an opportunity to put on the right finance on the table to help countries adapt and also perhaps to get a stronger signal on the end of fossil fuels.
And I suppose anyone listening to this, Matt, will think, is it actually going to do anything to limit temperature rises on the planet to 1.5 degrees Celsius?
I think that's the very big question. I think it's in the short term, the answer to that is no. But in the longer term, the direction of travel is clear here. And if in the next 5 to 7 years, as scientists are blue in the face from saying, countries really get a grip on their emissions, then it keeps that 1.5 within reach. That's the phrase that's used now, within reach. So I think it does signal more cuts, more ambition from different countries and an ultimate end to the use of fossil fuels.
Matt McGrath in Dubai. There's a warning that parts of Sudan are at risk of slipping into what's been called catastrophic hunger conditions. The country has been in the grip of a conflict lasting 8 months. The World Food Programme says that 18 million people in Sudan are facing acute levels of hunger, more than double the number of a year ago. 5 million people across Sudan have been displaced both inside and outside the country since April. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy told me about the effect of the civil war.
It's been huge and devastating. As you said there, it's the highest levels of hunger ever recorded. And this is the harvest season from October to around February, when usually they have food during the year. But now, since almost everything has been disrupted, you cannot transport anything in much of the country. It means that people are going hungry. And those who would be able to help, the aid agencies, have not been able to reach the vast majority of people of the worst affected places, including the capital, Khartoum, where the fighting started. The World Food Programme says that in the last 3 months, it has only managed to access Khartoum once during a lull in fighting. A few days ago, we heard from the International Council of the Red Cross saying that one of their convoys came under attack even after they had negotiated access. So such is the situation for the aid agencies, and civilians have been caught up in all this.
So it's very dangerous for the aid agencies. Is it also happening that aid is being looted?
Aid is being looted as well. We're talking about funding shortfalls that have made it very difficult for aid agencies to raise enough. So even with the little that they have, it's very difficult to distribute. It's very dangerous for their teams.
So if you can't reach people, how do you help them?
It's extremely difficult. And so they're saying, you know, the only way to reach people, they're trying to negotiate with the two sides. The regional bloc, IGAD, is leading some of the negotiations, political negotiations. Over the weekend, they announced a breakthrough. But shortly after that, General Burhan, who is the de facto leader of Sudan, and he leads the National Army, one of the warring factions, disowned that alleged breakthrough and said he has now vowed that he will continue fighting either to victory or martyrdom. So the future looks bleak for Sudan on the fighting front as well as on the political front. And that just means more suffering for the people of Sudan.
And are lots of people leaving?
A lot of people leaving. Already 6.3 or 6.5 million have been displaced, many of them within the country. Those who have made it outside the country are going to countries that are already fragile, like Libya, like Chad. So things are already difficult there. Some of the areas have been cut off by floods because of the ongoing rains. And so it's difficult to reach them even when they manage to flee the country.
Anne Soy. To India next, where there's been a security scare after two intruders stormed the parliament chamber. Kagoli Ghosh Dasida is an MP who saw what happened.
From galleries they came into the, jumped into the Lok Sabha, and they started shouting slogans and they're spreading some gas inside. They're running about in the Lok Sabha, inside the house.
Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etharajan told me more.
There were some dramatic scenes in the lower house of Indian Parliament this morning. While the session was on, all of a sudden, a man jumped from the public gallery and he was running over the desks. And soon after, one of the MPs said that there was also another man. So they were all trying to catch them. Initially, they thought this man accidentally fell from the gallery. This is the new Parliament building. But then later on, they realized these two people were shouting slogans. And then they were trying to run over the desks. Then the other MPs tried to catch them. And then they set off gas can, which emitted yellow smoke. So there was a bit of a confusion for a few minutes, but then the MPs were able to overpower these people. And then by that time, the security ran into the chamber and then took them into custody. While all this was happening, a few minutes later, there was also commotion outside the Parliament building. Two other people, including a woman, were setting off this yellow gas canisters and then raising slogans about what the Indian media says, down with the dictatorship. And also they spoke about unemployment.
So Anbarasan, what do we know about them?
The initial details are sketchy, and a couple of people are from the southern Indian state of Karnataka and some from northern India. So they were given passes by the MPs. Usually what happens is your local MP or any other MP can issue a pass so that you can go and visit these galleries to watch the proceedings in the lower house of parliament. So as far as now, the authorities are saying there are no any terror angle or there was no intention of causing any big damage. But it is seen as a major security breach because this is in the most protected place in the Indian capital, that is Indian Parliament. So several MPs, after this incident was over, they were all questioning the government and also complaining to the Speaker of the House on how this can be allowed to happen. The most important thing was this was also, today was the anniversary of the 2001 attack on Indian Parliament that set off big tensions between India and Pakistan. So they were asking the government to come out with a clear and detailed report on how this was allowed to happen.
Anbarasan Etharajan. Top executives at Chinese property developer Country Garden are having their salaries cut back as the company continues to struggle with colossal debts amid a wider crisis in the Chinese real estate sector. Here's our Asia business correspondent, Nick Marsh.
It's the third time in 2 years that Country Garden executives have had their pay reduced. In that time, the salary of chief executive, Mo Bin, has dropped from $2.1 million a year to just $16,000. It's a drop in the ocean compared to the $186 billion of debt that the company is currently facing, but it's a sign of how bad things are in China's property market more broadly. It's become a major political headache for Beijing, as many people in China typically invest their life savings in property.
Nick Marsh. The sci-fi horror Stranger Things has become one of the most watched English-language series in Netflix history. Set in the 1980s, it follows the supernatural events which take place in the small U.S. town of Hawkins, Indiana. Now it's been turned into a stage show, a prequel to the TV drama packed with stunts and lighting effects. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher went to meet two of its main cast members, Louis McCartney, who plays Henry Creel, and Ella Karina Williams, who plays Patty Williams.
From Hawkins, Indiana, to London's West End, the Stranger Things phenomenon continues. A new play which explores the origins of one of the program's supervillains opens this week.
I didn't fit in with the other children. Something was wrong with me.
The story revolves around Henry Creel, a strange child who becomes a monster.
Most people fear spiders.
Playing Henry Creel is really fun. What we've been exploring as a young person, young Henry Creel, is in the TV show, it's like he's this psychotic killer, and that's sometimes how he's told as the story or like shown to the audience. But there's this deeper side to him that we're exploring that maybe it wasn't as plain as it seems. Like, there's other factors, there's people around him. And Henry's too smart for his own good and thinks too much. And just what's the recursions of that and how does that affect him and the world?
And you're a new character, aren't you? Your Stranger Things fans won't have seen you before. You're being introduced in this.
It's really exciting, yeah. I don't know how much I can say about her. I don't want to give too much away. But she is Henry's love interest. And she, I would describe her as on a journey of self-discovery, a bit nerdy, a bit sassy, But again, struggling with her own internal demons.
The play is shrouded in secrecy, but the show is one of Netflix's biggest hits. So what's it like joining the Stranger Things universe?
Oh, it's just like confetti in my brain. It was just insane, man. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah,
it's
it is mind-blowing.
It's crazy.
If you watch the series, you'll know it's full of 1980s nostalgia. This show is going to take you back to the 1950s.
Taking Stranger Things from screen to stage has been a long process, but rehearsals are over and it's ready for its opening night.
Charlotte Gallagher chatting there to Louis McCartney and Ella Karuna-Williams. Still to come on the podcast, why the bloodthirsty cats of Waldorf are being put on curfew.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, and this is The Global Story from the BBC World Service.
China and America came together and agreed on this climate issue.
We're here to look beyond the headlines, peel back lazy assumptions, and give you a fresh global perspective on the stories that matter.
Is Europe tiring in terms of its support for Ukraine?
There will have to be some kind of negotiation to end this war.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The number of people forced to flee their homes because of conflict or persecution has reached a record high this year, more than 110 million. Now the UN is urging countries to do more to help them. At the start of a three-day summit in Geneva, the head of the UN's refugee agency, Filippo Grandi, warned there was a severe shortfall in funding as hostility grows in Western countries towards refugees.
Let's remember that most refugees, 75% to be precise, are hosted by low- and middle-income countries, often already struggling themselves to provide and care for their own citizens. This is why international support is so key and must be reinforced.
Well, the Global News podcast's Janet Jalil is at the summit and told me more about what it's hoping to achieve.
Never before have we seen so many refugees and displaced people, partly because of conflicts like Ukraine, Sudan and Gaza, but also increasingly because of climate change. So that's why the UN is hosting this huge forum with thousands of delegates, including world leaders, to address one of the biggest challenges of our age. The first such refugee forum was 4 years ago, yet in that time, the numbers forced to flee their homes have only risen ever higher. But instead of more help, international funding to support refugees has actually fallen. And we've seen anti-immigrant parties and politicians gaining support in Western nations because of a perception that they're being swamped by refugees. And Jordan's King Abdullah told this forum that it's actually lower income countries like his that are doing the most to support refugees. He said, for example, this has placed huge pressure on Jordan's scarce water resources. So the aim of this conference is to encourage pledges to help refugees to try to tackle the root causes, but also to help to ease the pressure on nations like Jordan, Bangladesh, Colombia and Uganda, where the overwhelming majority of the world's refugees are based.
And Janet, one of the biggest controversies in this area right now is UK plans to send refugees to Rwanda. What's being said about that?
Yes, that's been in the news a lot. A plan that was blocked by Britain's top court last month, which the government is pushing through Parliament. At the same time, Britain has made fresh pledges of financial help for refugees at this conference. The International Development Minister was here, Andrew Mitchell. The money being offered to give help to refugees in Africa, for example, with education and skills, is tiny compared to the money that the UK has spent on its controversial Rwanda plan, more than $300 million so far, even though not a single asylum seeker has yet been deported to Rwanda. Nevertheless, Mr. Mitchell defended his plan.
When it comes to Rwanda, I would completely reject your assertion that this is not a safe country. The UN High Commission for Refugees submitted a lot of evidence to the British courts against Rwanda, but the day after the decision was made, the UNHCR took over 160 people by plane to Rwanda from Libya. They would never have done that if they did not regard Rwanda as a safe country.
But the UNHCR says deporting refugees or building walls to keep them out or ignoring international human rights law is a distraction from the serious efforts that are needed to help share the responsibility of helping refugees.
And the summit will be hearing, won't it, from refugees themselves?
Yes, there are a number of speakers, and there has been a big focus on getting refugees to tell their own stories. For instance, there's an Afghan woman who became an Olympic cyclist who's addressing this summit, a refugee from South Sudan who hosts a radio show at his refugee camp in Kenya, and a very high-profile former displaced person is the Colombian vice president, Francia Marquez, who before she entered politics was an environmental activist and was forced to flee her home with her children after death threats from illegal miners. So we're going to have a wide range of voices, including from the people most affected themselves.
Janet Jalil in Geneva. One of the British Army's first Rastafarian soldiers has won a claim of race discrimination and harassment against the Ministry of Defence here in the UK. Dwight Pyle Gray, who was a member of the Band of the Grenadier Guards, was accused of playing the race card when he tried to enter his barracks. The white guard on duty, he says, didn't believe he could be a soldier. Mr. Pyle Gray, who's given his first broadcast interview to the BBC, says his case shows that in the army it's worse to accuse someone of racism than it is to be a racist. He spoke to our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
I was the first Rasta with locks to join the British Army in 2005, so I was under no illusion as to what I might encounter. But I joined at 37 years old. I joined for a purpose and to play the horn. I knew that I was going to be able to do that. And I joined with incredible optimism that things could only be better having joined.
What was the experience of being a black Rastafarian in the British Army, the first, in those 16, 17 years?
Some people were really interested and wanted to talk to me and find out about things. But some people wanted to trip me up, ask me questions such as, how do you get away with that hair?
And what about in terms of overt racism?
I had experience of people using the N-word, and people referring to the size of my genitals because I'm a black guy, and all of that kind of stuff. What people would say, well, it's just banter. Is it banter?
Let's talk about the sort of event in July 2021.
I had left my ID card inside. I spoke to the guy on the gate and said, look, I've left my ID inside. But his reaction was that he didn't believe. He actually stuck his head back into the guard room and said, this gentleman thinks he's left his ID inside, in kind of air quotes. Does anybody know him? I was absolutely treated differently because of my appearance. There's no doubt in my mind. I've been doing this a long time, and I understand when there is a racial element to an interaction. They accused me of playing the race card, and in fact, when the manager accused me of playing the race card, I absolutely lost my temper. That's the thing that was so offensive, that they had no understanding or concept of what they were actually saying was racist. I thought I was the victim, but papers show that two soldiers who were involved with me were actually treated as victims. They were reassured that that action was being taken against me. I was treated as though I was a criminal.
Don't you think the army has made efforts to address this problem?
Racism doesn't exist at the top. If you're a black colonel, nobody's going to be calling you the N-word. They're going to be calling you sir because of the hierarchy. But if you're a black private, guess what? You're going to be hearing that every single day.
Dwight Pyle Gray. An international animal welfare group says at least 100 elephants have died in Zimbabwe's biggest national park as waterholes there have dried up. Philip Kovawoga with the International Fund for Animal Welfare told us more about how the problem could continue into next year.
What we have experienced is a prolonged dry spell. We expected to have received rains almost 5 weeks ago. And because of the long dry spell and these drought conditions, water shortages, food shortages, and extreme high temperatures have really impacted the elephants, and with the park authorities reporting that to date we have lost plus or minus 100 jumbos. And with the anticipated El Nino phenomena in the landscape, in the region, we anticipate to receive less and less rainfall with high temperatures for the most of the season up to March 2024.
Philip Kuvaburga from the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Now, sleeper trains, which are being reintroduced across Europe as part of a push for greener, cheaper travel. Berlin and Paris will be first to get an overnight connection, and it's thought the prices will be cheaper than the day fare, which is around $380 per person. Lisa Louis went along for the ride.
I'm at Berlin train station, getting by day train from this town in my home country to Paris in France, where I live now, is actually quite difficult. It takes about 8.5 hours, but now there is a night line, which will take me back to Paris, seemingly in the blink of an eye, if I manage to go to sleep, that is.
Hello, ich muss in den 421er.
Okay. Taking a plane from Berlin to Paris would cost around $97. On this train, basic prices vary between $37 and $86. But the environment is probably the biggest winner from people taking trains. Planes produce about 28 times as much CO2 as trains on the same journey, according to Brussels-based NGO Transport and Environment. The National Railroad Operators of Austria, Germany, France and Belgium are jointly running this so-called night jet connection. Here's Kurt Bauer from Austria's ÖBB.
We have around 30 different routes. We currently have 1.5 million passengers per year, and we plan to have 3 million by end of this decade on night trains. The Courchette coach you're traveling in has been built in the 70s, and we really want to get rid of those coaches.
It's now 12:45. Oh my God, but I think there's a fire and there's smoke in the hallways.
It's happening way too much, unfortunately, stuff like that.
Oh, really? What's your name?
Thibaut Constant.
Because you're taking the night train quite often?
Yeah, quite a lot. I'm a YouTuber specialized in train. Unfortunately, the rolling stock is just way too old.
So it seems that they left something for too long in the microwave. It's now 30 minutes later, and we are rolling again.
I'm Clément Beaune, I'm the French Minister for Transportation. So there were only two years ago. We will go up to 10 between now and the end of the decade, and we do hope to add to this some extra European night train lines. Already we have put more than €150 million of investments, and we will add to that a few hundred millions.
We are now arriving at Paris Est train station with a delay of only 15 minutes.
Thank you for choosing NightJet to make your journey.
Compared to the 2 hours a plane trip would take, this was 14 hours on a sleeper train, and it didn't involve much sleep for me. So I think I'm going to catch up on that now.
Lisa Louis. We already know that the often cuddly domestic cat is in fact a fearsome predator, wreaking havoc on local wildlife in any number of blameless suburban settings. But new research has established that cats are actually driving some species towards extinction, as Terry Egan reports.
That's the singing of the crested lark. But in the German town of Waldorf, that singing is in danger of being silenced by cats. As a consequence, people there have been ordered to keep their pet cats indoors during the spring. Crested larks, you see, nest on the ground. The order is just one result of what's been highlighted by a study done in the United States. It suggests cats prey on up to 2,000 species, and nearly a fifth of them are on conservation lists. New Zealand is a good example, where it's known cats have eaten species that are now extinct, such as the Stevens Island rock wren and the New Zealand quail. Cats can be devastating on islands, which are often home to endangered species that are vulnerable when cats are introduced into previously cat-free environments. As for what to do about the problem, well, tips include fitting bells and bright collars in order to warn prey, and keeping cats inside. Sterilizing and microchipping are also recommended. And while none of that sounds very cuddly, it could well help birds such as the crested lark.
Terry Egan, pausing for thought there. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hey, you. Yeah, talking to you. Welcome to Audible, where there's endless ways to ignite your imagination, like chase your thrills, slay your demons, even journey into the great unknown. And if you're lucky, discover someone, something new to love. Hear the latest audiobooks, podcasts, and originals at audible.ca.